6:14, prayers, if you can, if you do believe in that, or positive thoughts or whatever you can do for the people in Florida, because they are getting ready to get hit and hard by Hurricane Helene, and we can only be thankful that it's not coming here. I do know a lot of you own property over in that area, and I hope everything works out all right. And at some point, we're going to talk about later in the week how, depending on how bad the damage is in Florida with the reinsurance market, it could hurt the efforts that they're making here to lower our insurance rates, but we'll have to see how it happens, how it turns out. Weather-wise for us, nice north breeze out there today. It feels nice and fall-like this morning. Highs today of only 86. Tomorrow morning, really going to feel nice. Lows on the north shore, low 60s, upper 60s on the south shore, and then highs of 84, which for people in the northeast might sound kind of silly that we would be excited about this, but we are. Low humidity throughout the weekend. Highs of 88 into the next 5 days after that, and still no Arctic cold fronts or anything like that on the way. Ted Rossman joins us now, Bankrate Senior Industry Analyst. Morning, Ted. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. September consumer confidence fell the most in 3 years. That's the headline. Tell me what all of that means.
It's important because economists watch consumer confidence and consumer sentiment numbers to really gauge the path forward. You know, in other words, if people are feeling really lousy about the economy, they're less likely to buy homes and cars and invest in new washing machines and, you know, things like that. I mean, some stuff we have to buy, but the more discretionary, bigger ticket kind of purchases, it's something that people watch, and it can be a leading indicator of recession sometimes. And as you said, right now, people are not feeling so great about things. You know, people are especially worried about the job market. That's really taken over as the biggest worry over inflation.
Tell me how they conduct this survey. They just ask people, do they surface what the people feel through a series of questions, or do they just outright say, do you have confidence in this or that?
It's a detailed questionnaire. It's something that the Conference Board has done for a while with this Consumer Confidence Index. The University of Michigan has a similar consumer sentiment index that's been widely watched for a while. So it is a very detailed scientific questionnaire, but it's getting at things like the state of the economy, the job market, inflation. The consumer or the Conference Board's index was really especially downbeat on jobs. They found that only 31% of participants said that jobs were plentiful. This is kind of mirroring what the Federal Reserve is talking about, because as we know, they have a dual mandate from Congress. They're supposed to promote stable prices and maximum employment, and they've really been squarely focused on inflation the past few years, and then just recently have pivoted to more of the other side of things. And they feel like inflation's under better control, but the job market has been weakening. I mean, to be fair, it had been doing really, really well. The 3.4% unemployment rate we saw earlier this year was tied for the lowest in 50 years. And, you know, now that's risen about a full percentage point. And, you know, we don't want it to get much worse. It's still pretty low, historically speaking, but, you know, this is one that it's been ticking up in the wrong direction, so it bears watching.
I don't know, understand about this job market, because I talk to people that are in the you know, like Monster and these people, and they tell me that it's an employee's market, and they can look and move around. And I'm old school, Ted, so I'm of the ilk where if you get a job and you're doing well, you know, you don't just bounce around for grins and giggles. You stick with it. And I know that's not the way the economy runs these days, or the job market works these days. But I don't know. They talked about COVID, people doing the big quit and then finding a job that they want. And when I talk to these people with Monster, they make it seem as though, man, the jobs are out there just crazy. You can go be whatever you want, make whatever you want, do whatever you want, and dictate your own terms. But what this tells me is that that's not necessarily the case.
It feels like the pendulum has swung more in favor of the employer. You know, as you said, a few years ago, we had that whole great resignation thing. Following the pandemic, a lot of people reimagined their work lives. You know, there was a time that there were about 2 job openings for every 1 person looking for work. Now that swung more towards a 1-to-1 kind of relationship. I mean, to be fair, the job market's still pretty good in the grand scheme of things, mm-hmm. but it's not as good as it was a year or two ago. Another key metric to watch is wage growth, which has actually been outpacing inflation for the past year or so, We need to see more of that. You know, that's factoring into this low consumer sentiment data because, you know, really, according to that University of Michigan study, consumer sentiment's only regained about half of its COVID drop. You know, you remember the pandemic set in, there was a huge drop in consumer sentiment. We've really only regained half of that. And I would blame inflation as the main reason why that. It's really kind of masked some underlying strength in the economy that even though the job market's been pretty good, even though economic growth has been pretty solid, a lot of people are not feeling good because inflation's gobbling up whatever gains they're making. We've started to make inroads against that, but it's been pretty slow going.
Yeah, let me pick it up when we come back, because I'm still trying to get a handle, Ted, on what the economy's like and whether the economy is good or bad or if it's that simple, because I think it all depends on what's working for you. I know in my life, throughout my career, it seems as though I've always been counter-cyclical to national trends, where when the economy was not doing so well, things were banging for me, and when the economy was doing great, I was not doing so well. So I don't know how you get an average on this, and when you talk about wage growth outpacing inflation, that tends to make me think it's kind of like a dog chasing its tail, where that's going to make inflation worse. But you can talk us through all of that when we come back. If y'all have any questions, 504-260-1870. That's the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text line. You text your questions in. I'll pass them along to Ted Rossman, Bankrate Senior Industry Analyst, when we come back on WWL. I'm Tommy Tucker, 620. Let's look at traffic. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I don't mention this often enough, but you can follow me on Twitter, at TTuckerWWL. You can get sometimes my expert analysis of ongoing football games. I say that tongue-in-cheek because, you know, I got opinions like everybody else. But you can also send your questions to me if you have like them at times like this, as we talked to Ted Rossman, Bankrate Senior Industry Analyst. Consumer confidence tumbled this month. Why? You can also send your tech questions in, text them to the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870. So tell me, Ted Rossman, when it comes to the economy, I don't know. My 401k is doing great. Inflation's eating me up. I don't know if it's good or bad. How do most people judge this?
You're right. It is a very mixed bag, and this has been the case the past few years. I would really attribute a lot of this to economic inequality, and people are having different experiences. You know, you could come up with several data points that are quite positive. The fact that GDP growth has been good and inflation has come down without a recession, and you know, the job market's been doing well, but there's negativity, too. I mean, the unemployment rate has risen almost a full point. A lot of people feel that they've been kind of left behind, that their wages have not kept pace with inflation. Credit card debt is at record highs. Credit card delinquencies and auto loan delinquencies are both at their highest point in more than a decade. So, you know, we see the conflicting indicators, and this has really been the case for much of the past few years. I would say that the pandemic years made economic inequality worse, and the gap has continued to grow.
So when it comes to economic inequality, from an economic standpoint, not a social justice standpoint, none of that, but from a purely economic standpoint, how much of a threat is that to the economy of the United States, or is it one?
It's a good question. I mean, the Federal Reserve says that the economy is in pretty good shape. Now, even there, we see some level of contradiction, because even though that was their mantra when they had the press conference last week and announced their first interest rate cut in about 4 years, you know, the other side of that was they made a larger cut than expected, 50 basis points instead of 25. And, you know, some people even there see a contradiction. It's like, well, wait a second, is the economy good or bad? You know, normally that level of cut is reserved for more of a crisis level sort of economic situation, and yet they're telling us, you know, things are good. And, you know, the answer seems to be that they want to get out ahead of any further weakening in the job market. And you know, people criticize the Fed for being too slow to raise interest rates when inflation was spiking in 2021 and 22, and then they had to do these larger hikes to play catch up. And, you know, the way this affects the average consumer is that the Fed is affecting the price of money. They're basically setting borrowing costs, and that can either slow or stimulate the economy depending on what they're doing. But, you know, even the most educated, powerful policymakers are not totally sure what to make of this. It's been a weird few years.
You know, so as I talk about this, somebody texted in and said economic inequality, what he's saying is he's blaming people for their own success. You shouldn't be so be successful so that everyone else will be poor, too. I guarantee you this is somebody that is not in the top 1%. I guarantee you this is somebody that makes, I don't know, but I would guess they're in the lower 20%. But somehow, and I don't know anything about this person that texted in, but somehow the message has been gotten, has been put through that if you favor policies that favor the top 1%, the top 10%, you're doing it in the name of patriotism. And that's why I asked what effect it would have on the economy. Talk about, if you will, when it comes to unequal distribution of the income in the United States and wealth in the United States, just what the numbers show, if you would, Ted. And again, not from a justice and none of that, just from the economic, the number part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have a ton of hard numbers on that. I mean, I could say that, you know, overall, the economy has been chugging along and has been growing. And, you know, I feel like one of the biggest themes here is, remember last year, everybody said there was going to be a recession. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you know, 100% of forecasters in some surveys were calling for a recession and feeling that that was really what was needed to break inflation. Now, the Fed has seemingly brought inflation down without causing a recession. But there has been this kind of feeling of rolling recessions, if you will. You know, certain sectors have been more affected. It's felt at times that there's been a recession in the housing market the past couple of years, and high interest rates have really dented home buying. Technology, media, these sectors have had a lot of layoffs. But overall, the data has been more positive.
Thank you, Ted. I appreciate your time. Ted Rossman, Bankrate, senior industry analyst. And I'm just talking about, for those that don't understand, I'm talking about the distribution of wealth in the United States, which is becoming more concentrated with the top 1-10%. Now, you might think that that's good for the economy, and that's your opinion if you think it is, or you might think it's bad. But I'm just talking about the numbers and what they are. And I think sometimes people that make $50,000 to $100,000 think that somebody's coming after them when we talk about income distribution. And I'm not going after anybody. I'm just saying that maybe, you know, that could be a problem the United States is going to face eventually. Top 1% of households in the U.S. hold 30.9% of the country's wealth, while the bottom 50% hold 2.6%. And the disparity is getting worse each and every year. 6:30, we'll talk to Mike Strain. We come back. Look, I don't take anything from anybody. I'm all for working as hard as you can. Right now, it's time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Chris Miller. 6:43, 17 till 8. The weather's going to be nice here. Lower humidity. You'll feel it this morning, especially tomorrow morning and through the weekend. Dry highs between 85 and 90. And God bless the people in Florida because they are getting ready to get hammered. Mike Strain joins us now, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Man, I'm doing very well. It is raining here in Washington, D.C. I've been here 3 days in FEMA headquarters. Mm-hmm. I was appointed to serve on a planning for animal welfare subcommittee to the National Advisory Council, and that's by an act of Congress. And so we've been here working, basically plowing new ground. You know, when we have storms, in Louisiana, we're very good now at evacuating our animals, you know, dealing with service animals, pets, you know, public, you know, and assistance animals. But that's not the same way across the United States and across the territories. And so this group was put together, 13, quote, experts in the field, and we're going through FEMA policy and writing FEMA policy, and we hope that it's going to be accepted by FEMA, looking at the best methods, and a lot of it's modeled on what we do, you know, in Louisiana and in Florida and some of the other states. And so it's a lot of work going on, but it goes down all the way to guidance at the local level and how it comes up through the state to the federal government. And then working on what FEMA will assist with and what FEMA will not assist with. And that's always been a big deal. We've been very fortunate there in Louisiana and in GOSEP, Governor's Office of Homeland Security. And when we deal with that, we've found ways to deal with those things that are not funded by any mechanism. You know, but we've always had to, you know, work, and it takes time to figure these things out. So now we're looking at a national model, because as you look at Hurricane Helen, you know, she's going to hit Florida really hard and then move up through the heartland. But the idea is, you know, that we learned from Hurricane Katrina, if the pets don't leave, the people don't leave, and then it becomes a rescue. And so all of this is based on, you know, really better safety, you know, to get the humans out, but also how do we deal with this? How we deal with the pets? What is a pet, you know, and what is a service animal, and how do we deal with it?
Mike, I don't say this to curry favor with you because Lord knows you don't need my endorsement, but I do think the world of you, and I'm just wondering why you're up there. Have you been able to, or are you guys doing anything to kind of help with the preparations
absolutely.
In Florida? Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I'm at the National FEMA headquarters, and I can tell you that the Central Command, when I'm telling you it is, it's buzzing like a beehive. They are working very, very hard. I'll be at NASA later today, and, you know, looking at their satellite center. But yes, everything's in gear. A number of the members that serve on these committees have already been mobilized. So all of that is an in go. And what we are doing here, and again, I was appointed by FEMA and it's as from an act of Congress to dive in and look at the policies. How do we improve what we're doing? And the main thing is that we have guidance. In other words, you don't have to try to figure it out each time that there's guidance that says, this is how this should be handled. This is who's responsible for what. And then we're trying to get a greater cost share or a cost share period from FEMA. And I'll give you, for instance, if, you know, we are evacuating animals, say we evacuate from New Orleans and we're going to Alexandria, and you need tractor trailers to move the pets. Mm-hmm. Well, that's generally not covered under the Stafford Act. How do we do that? How do we fund that? You know, and where do we get those precious dollars? Or in the case, you know, where you have, you know, situations where you've got to get fuel so that you can, or fuel or assets or you know, or food or hay, if there's a big fire coming, how do you do that? Who helps pay for that? And it's always been that animals were, quote, under Department of Agriculture, USDA, but USDA is a post-event type of situation. They will come and help. But we need, you know, what's going on there. And the reason it's coming to FEMA, because FEMA's in Central Command with us, and we're all working together. And somewhere in Central Command, when we're there on site, somebody there has got to figure out how to deal with every issue. And so as we look at what's happening in other parts of the United States, we're trying to develop a model to where it is streamlined, it is efficient, and, you know, to help everyone do a better job.
Mike, when you talk about pets, you're talking about household pets like dogs, cats, birds. Or are you talking about, is it when you talk about agriculture, it's dogs, is it a different thing when you're talking about cattle and goats and whatever people
yes,
ranch?
Yes, there's a very big delineation. You know, dogs and cats, household pets that are kept for companionship and pleasure. But you can also have, you know, someone may have a small horse that's a pet. How do you deal with that? How do you get them to a shelter if they have no method to do that? Livestock, commercial livestock is handled a little bit differently. But we also have to have the ability, if we need to get water to them when it's, you know, this is pre-storm evacuation and post-storm and recovery. And we have to make sure that nothing falls through the gap, because if you have a herd of anything, whether it's a chicken house or cattle, and they don't get food or water or whatever they need, and then they die, now you've got a public health issue, right? You've got contamination. So we have to do everything we can do. And someone there has got to be able to step up to the plate. And you may have an entity, a municipality or a state that doesn't have the assets readily available, and we may need FEMA to bring fuel or water, or in the case, you know, like in California with the fire, hay or whatever. And so we've always worked with volunteers, or we would set up a financial situation where the farmers would sign a note on a loan if we couldn't get it covered by any other mechanism, because under state law, under our Constitution, we cannot give away anything of value, period. We have to have a funding source from somewhere, either from the legislature or using volunteer dollars or federal dollars. But the main thing is that we have to have a mechanism to supply those needs to prevent, mass casualties in the animal world, and also so that the people will evacuate and leave. So if you have someone that has, you know, four horses and said, look, I'm staying here, I'm not leaving, so the storm is coming, I have nowhere to go. Well, we have to have a way to get them, say, you know, to a shelter, to Lamar Dixon or to the one in Alexandria or Bastrop or wherever, and then have a mechanism to take care of them once they are there.
Mike, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. You know, you don't want to wish anything on anybody at all, and we feel for our friends to the east of us, and a lot of people own property there that live here. I get that. But I'd like to talk about, if that thing had come here, how disastrous it would have been. I'm talking about Francine, and also Nothing happens in a vacuum. When it comes to the agriculture of the United States, what kind of damage this could do to the markets and different commodities, et cetera. So we'll pick it up with Mike Strain. We come back. Very smart man, Dr. Mike Strain, a skilled veterinarian. He's in Washington working with FEMA. As he said, I can imagine it's just a frenzy of activity as Florida gets ready for the approach of Helene. We'll take a break. We come back. More with Mike, 650, 10 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. 6:56, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mike Strain, Commissioner of the Department of Agriculture and Forestry, Dr. Mike Strain, veterinarian, who's in Washington right now with FEMA. Before we get to the hurricane in Florida, Mike, and commodities and so forth, we talked yesterday with an economist about a likely strike at the port among dock workers. What kind of effect would that have on farmers, and how much are you guys watching that?
We're watching that very, very closely. One of the things, you know, on the docks, especially what we had before with the dock issues during COVID, we couldn't get spare parts. And if you look at one of the big issues, blades for cane cutters, for instance, were on those machines, and we're fixing to go into cane. So if you can't get the blades in, it really, and parts, it really can shut down a lot of agriculture. But also, you know, now is the time we have to move our products offshore as they come in. In other words, there's not enough storage for corn and beans and rice. It's got to be in motion everywhere from the heartland all the way down the river. And if those ships don't sail, then it backs up the whole system, which then depresses the commodity prices and really throws, quote, a monkey wrench in the whole system, because then you get instability and uncertainty. And so we're really hoping that it doesn't affect especially the lower Mississippi River, but it'll have a dramatic effect on the east and west coast ports. Especially if you go into the Carolinas and if you go into like Los Angeles. And so before we've been, you know, busier in our ports here in Louisiana, but it can have a devastating effect because you have to think about, you know, everything in commerce is interrelated now, and, you know, spare parts, technology, and it gets down. If you remember a couple of years ago, we couldn't get the chips, the microchips that had to go into the trucks that were needed to operate the anti-pollution part of these tractor trailers. And so when if that microchip went down, then the truck wouldn't run, and then we couldn't haul the grain. So you've got all these things interrelated, and we are watching this very, very closely.
Mike, you know, again, if Helene, and I say my prayers every night, but if Helene had hit this area, our area, at this time, that could have been devastating for the sugarcane crop and Lord knows what else.
Especially, right? Yes. So if you start off in the lower parishes with the sugarcane, because, you know, right now, very little of the actual cane going into the mills has been harvested. It would have affected the plant cane dramatically because we're still having some issues with plant cane from the previous storm. But also, it would have further lodge that cane down, which would have resulted in higher cost to harvest and less sugar. So we really needed this good weather that we're having, you know, for recovery. And then as you move into the northern parts and central parts of Louisiana, right now, you know, cotton is at risk because all the cotton bowls are open. We've only harvested about 22%, and a lot of rain and bad weather could really, really affect that. And then soybeans, you know, right now we've got about 95% of them harvested, so the other ones part, that would have hurt. And then on our sweet potatoes. And so we really, you know, have dodged a big bullet here. So not only would we have had loss of quality, it would have delayed harvest. So we're very, very fortunate. And, of course, going through the mid where it's going now and kind of ending up almost headed towards the Midwest, you're going to see it affect sweet potatoes. You can see it affect peanuts and other crops.
You don't want to wish anything bad on anybody else, and God bless.
No.
You. Thank you, Mike. Safe travels, all right?
Take care.
And enjoy that high temperature of 70 degrees, you son of a gun. Mike Strain and the nation's...
Yes, nice.
I bet it is. Mike Strain working hard in the nation's capital with FEMA. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Peyton Malone and Pat Connick and more. 7:16 now, our friend Senator Pat Connick joins us. We're going to talk about tax reform in the state, but then 17-year-old Carlos Taylor escaped, and I know Pat's been all over this juvenile justice thing, so we thought we'd start with that. How you doing, Senator Connick?
Hey, good morning, Tommy.
Tell me about this latest escape, about the JJIC, how it relates to state law, what can be done, and a woman was carjacked at the LSU Dental Center and more. Thoughts on everything.
Listen, We've been looking at this for the last few years, and one of the bills we passed in the legislature this past session was that if there's an escape, whoever has control over this juvenile must notify the media, must notify the police immediately, and then get the word out so they can get this whoever escapes back into custody. And the law requires the entity or the individual to notify within 10 minutes. And in this case, it was not done. So people are now aware of the law. Hopefully going forward, we can get things fixed.
He's still on the loose, as far as you know?
That's what I'm hearing. They have not called him yet.
And as I understand it, I think this kid carjacked somebody for the first time when he was 12.
It's a bad situation with this individual. You know, he needs help, and he escaped, and we got to get him back and try to get him help and go forward from there. But we have to do a better job of notifying the public and letting letting people know what's going on. If we keep this a secret, doesn't work. It doesn't help anybody.
Pat, I say this again, like I told Mike Strain, not to curry favor with you because you don't need my endorsement, but I do know you well. You're a friend. And I know that you are a good guy, and you're not a lock-em-up-and-throw-away-the-key kind of guy. That being said, you also have a responsibility to protect the public as an elected official. And I went over to the Juvenile Justice Intervention Center with Freddie King. I don't know if you know Freddie, fellow Shaw graduate, and met with some of the people that are there, and I pray for him every night. You don't want to paint everybody with the same brush, but you do have to protect the public. So, the kids that were sitting there in the round circle that we had, and I realize they're probably hand-selected to put the best front forward, and I don't have a complaint with that at all, but they all said they were happier to be there than they were to be out because they had some structure, because they were going to school, they felt safe. This is a big old problem, and it goes beyond just, and I know it's a concern of yours, not just from a leader, but as a guy of faith and as a guy that wants to do the right by everybody. We can take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back because this is a long-term solution, a big old giant problem. I don't know how you fix it. I struggle with it every night when I pray. I really do. So I want to talk to you about that when we come back, all right?
Yes, sir.
And you can come back and talk about tax reform some other time. Pat Connick, or maybe we'll get some time. Pat Connick, Louisiana State Senator, fellow Shaw graduate, proud to say. More when we return, 720 Traffic Now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Senator Pat Connick, who's been focused on juvenile justice and this for a long time, and the escapes from Avondale, and he is a good guy. I'm telling you, I know Pat for a long time. And no, seriously, Pat, and I know you're not, somebody texted in and said, and let me just read it, that punk doesn't need, quote, help. He needs a prison cell. 17 years is old enough to know the difference between right and wrong. Keep him locked up till he turns 18, learns to read, then put him in boot camp. Well, listen to what you just typed there. He's 17 now. You say keep him locked up until he turns 18 and learns to read. That's a couple of months. And let a drill sergeant teach him how to behave properly. These kids, and being at the Juvenile Justice Center with our mutual friend and Char graduate, Freddie King, I talk to these kids and they start, man, they're saying that, from the time they're four or five, sometimes the parents are in the house, sometimes they're not, sometimes it's siblings, sometimes it's the parents themselves that are teaching them how to get in a life of crime. So I know you as a parent and as a Christian, you look at it from the standpoint of kids that are four and five, and how do you fix that? You also look at it as this complex, layered problem of you can't treat everybody like a criminal, because if you do, then they start to think of themselves as a criminal. But you do have to protect the public. And this is one hell of a Rubik's Cube, Pat, and I don't even know how you go about beginning to solve it. Thoughts?
Tommy, we've been working on this a long time. We fixed the problem at Bridge City. That took a while. The folks who escape, the folks who cause problem, they're going to get the media attention, and they're going to get the let's just lock them up. They're bad actors, mm-hmm. and they are bad actors. They need to be locked up. But there's a lot of folks, a lot of kids that are getting help in the system, so we can't throw that away. We got to keep that focus on them to rehabilitate them and get them to be productive citizens. And I think we're going to do that to many, many of these juveniles. But there's a lot of eyes on the system now. The governor is really after this and trying to do the right thing. And I think we're going to get it right. This last incident shouldn't have happened. But because it happened, more and more focus is on what's the process of going forward. And the process is going to be on escapes. If they escape, notify the public immediately. Don't wait. And because we have a duty to protect the public, we don't want anyone hurt by these guys. Let's get them back into custody. And if they can't be rehabilitated, then you have to lock them up.
You always make the analogy of, you know, a contractor doesn't see walls in a house. A contractor or a plumber, electrician, they don't see walls. They see conduit. They see 2x4s. They see electrical boxes. And I use that as a metaphor because you, as an elected official, you know the problems of the juvenile justice system. You can't force people to be good parents. You can't legislate that. I don't know. What do you do for the kids now? And, Pat, this is what keeps me up, for the kids that are now 4 and 5 and going through what the kids that are at JJIC now that are 17 went through. So you're just funneling more into the system. How do you change that?
I don't know if you can, Tommy. There's always going to be an element of kids coming up with no parents, being born into a situation that's terrible. Now, we're lucky. I'm lucky to have a parent, two parents that love me and took care of me.
And Pat, let me ask you an honest question. Was there not something that you did in your life that could have gotten you in big trouble if you had continued down that road?
I have older brothers. I watched what they did, and I learned from them not to do things. So,
but you understand the point I'm making. It's all about opportunity and what we're exposed to, and but for the grace of God, all of us, who knows where we could be?
It's all about example. You know, you look at your family, you look at your faith, and do the right thing, try to do the right thing. Of course, you're going to mess up, but you always get that faith to go back on it. But many people don't have that, and I realize that. And those are the ones we need to help if we can help. But if we can't allow them, those who harm people and rob and carjack and steal, you know, we got to take care of those in the right way. That's why we have jails. So,
thank you, Pat. I appreciate your time and your efforts as a public servant. I really mean that, and I hope you come back and talk about tax reform one day. All right.
We need to change this.
And let me say this.
In the tax system.
Yeah, and let me say this real quick. If y'all ever have a chance to have Senator Pat Conix grilled buttered potatoes at a fair, don't miss it because he makes the best in the world. Am I wrong?
They're pretty good. That's
award-winning. Exactly. Thank you, sir. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Eric Smith about oil and gas. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Chris Miller. 7:44, 16 till 8, in case you've not noticed, there's a presidential election going on and conflicting presidential messages. I Googled oil and gas production under Biden and Trump, and some of the results I got. Under both Trump and Biden-Harris, U.S. oil and gas production surged to record highs despite very different energy goals. Oil and gas production skyrocketed under both Trump and Biden. How will U.S. oil production hit a record under Biden? Big oil is doing way better under Biden than under Trump. Why oil companies are raking in record profits under Joe Biden? I don't know. Let's see what's going on with Eric Smith, Professor Eric Smith, a professor over at Tulane's Institute of Energy. How you doing, Professor?
I'm doing fine. How are you this morning, Tommy?
I'm very well, sir. Remember, you got to keep this on the eighth grade level so everybody understands, including me, all right?
All right.
Let's
we'll
talk
go for
about
it.
Oil is not oil, and I don't know how would you, from the economic standpoint, from the energy production standpoint, from the profit-making standpoint, how do you gauge where oil and gas production is now in the United States?
Well, one of the things that's happened in the last 10 years is we have become an oil exporter, and that means that there's a whole bunch of people out there that don't care what the president thinks, whether he's a Democrat or a Republican. We're actively participating in that international market. Some people are upset about it, particularly some of the Democrats. And what they've done is sort of used marginal policy, if you will, very short-term policy. We're in the middle of an election year. And they have done things like put pauses on LNG exports, which isn't strictly oil, but it is energy. They have talked about, they've certainly delayed pipelines and other infrastructure that you need to move oil and gas around. So in the short term, I would say that oil is setting records in spite of the government's effects rather than because of them.
So,
that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I know you and I have had conversations before about President Biden and a love-hate relationship with oil and gas. It seems as though initially in the administration he was trying to curtail that as much as he could, domestic production. But with, and then he kind of changed his mind when he realized, and correct me if I'm saying anything inaccurate here, that that probably wasn't going to work.
Well, I think he figured out, and I think both candidates are guilty of telling people what they want to hear. But
precisely.
When,
I want to be clear about that, too.
So when he's speaking out in California, his story is a little different than when he's speaking in Louisiana or Texas. And that's true of both candidates. One thing we need to worry about here in Louisiana is we are very, very dependent on energy as one of the are the main pillar of our economy. It represents about 160,000 jobs in the state out of about 2 million total. That doesn't sound like a lot, but they're the highest paying jobs we've got on average. So just the fuel sector, which would include some of the refining as well as the getting it out of the ground step, that's about 66,000 jobs. So it's about a third of our premium jobs are in the oil and gas area. You compare that to power, you know, our friends at Entergy and Cleco, that's about 10,000 jobs.
Not only do what they say changes, sometimes their accent and tone of speech changes, Professor, depending on what area they're in. I don't know if you've noticed that at all or not. I say tongue-in-cheek. Let's talk about oil independence, because oil is not oil, and there's different types of oil that the refineries handle, correct?
That's right, and we've talked about that before. Basically, our Gulf Coast refineries are what we call complex refineries, and they're big. They're designed to basically process the cheapest oil they can find, which is usually heavy oil that's imported. We don't produce a lot of heavy oil ourselves. But it's imported, it takes a lot of processing, requires a lot of hydrogen to get rid of the sulfur in the oil, all those sorts of things. And that's the only kind of oil we really import anymore, is that heavy, sour oil. And the other side of the coin is that with the advent of all of the big shale plays, predominantly in Texas, like the Permian Basin, which spreads over into New Mexico, that's all relatively light oil, low sulfur oil. It's what the rest of the world needs because they don't have these big they don't all have these big complex refineries. So we've developed quite an export business for light sweet oil. At the same time, we're importing the heavy sour, or trying to, except most of the places we got it from are now under sanctions. So we're actually taking a hit in terms of our processing capacity, because the refineries were, as I said, built to handle a certain amount of this heavy oil, and they're not getting it.
Is a sanction different than a tariff?
The sanctions are different than a tariff. A tariff says you can bring it in, but you have to pay a penalty. The sanctions say you can't bring it in at all, and if you do, we'll put you in jail.
Okay, that's a big difference. We'll take a break, pick it up here. We'll come back. I got a question about production on federal as opposed to private lands. I got another question coming in about if the government says one thing, but they ignore that, then what real role does the government have in all of this? Professor Eric Smith will continue to explain it to us in a way we can all understand. Professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy, a lot of candidates saying a lot of different stuff, as they are prone to do. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, trying to get the truth on oil and gas production in light of the presidential claims on either side of the aisle, Democratic or Republican. Drill, baby, drill. Oil independence. Let me go back to that for a second, Professor, if I can. Can the United States ever be truly oil independent or energy independent when it comes to the type of oil that we need, or would it involve rebuilding refineries? Take me through all of that, if you can.
Yeah, I mean, we could. We're oil independent now because we're a net exporter.
Okay.
We export oil after we satisfy all our own needs. And the problem is this $1 trillion or so of invested assets that we've got that are and a design to run on one mix of oils, and you would have to change that. I mean, it wouldn't be that you would stop producing from the existing refineries, but they physically couldn't produce as much diesel and particularly the heavier products as they do today. So if you want to be energy independent, we can all pay more taxes and we can invest that in refineries, and those refineries will then be able to produce the same amount of fuel as they produce today. But it will be because we're running more of that lighter oil that we are currently exporting and less of the heavier oil that we're currently importing.
So it is not as easy as saying drill, baby, drill, accurate?
No, it isn't, because it's not. That's that's a great expression that came out of Alaska the last time around, but it's essentially not a drilling-constrained business. We can drill faster and much more efficiently than we were years ago, so that we can get as much oil out of the ground as we need. It's just you can't use that oil for anything. It has to go through a refinery and petrochemical plants to be put into a shape that you and I as a consumer can use it.
Let's talk about drilling on federal and private lands and percentage of each, or how I don't understand how that works.
Well, the basically all of the Indian reservations and all of the national parks, all of the land that's owned by the federal or controlled by the federal government has its own set of rules about drilling, and they are very lackadaisical in terms of their production because they're subject to so much political pressure. Most of our production comes from drilling on private land, and about the biggest concentration we have in the federal area is offshore, where you don't have any choice. It's either federal land or state land, but it's not your land. So that's where we do get a couple of million barrels a day of production that's on federal land, but the onshore federal land production is so tied up in red tape that it's at best, stable production and usually declining. And people don't really even like to bid on it because of all of the restrictions.
Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time and your insight and your information. Eric Smith, Professor at Tulane's Institute of Energy. When we come back, we're going to talk to Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. It's Fall Prevention Awareness Week. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than one in four older adults fall each year, but many of those falls are preventable. And if those of you that have had elderly parents, as have I, know that a lot of problems start with people falling and breaking hips or shoulders or something else, and then that starts a cascade of failing health. So if you can prevent that, we'll talk about that when we come back. We'll also talk with Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member, about the New Orleans City Council's Utility Council meeting and about the power outages that have happened. And currently, right now, they got some people, or at least as of 13 hours ago, some people that are without power. So we'll talk about it when we come back. WWL. 8:14, God bless the people in Florida. They're getting ready to get hit hard by Helene here. We got a little taste of fall in the air today, a bigger taste tomorrow, which is good. No Arctic cold front on the horizon or anything like that. But it is going to be nice to have a break from the hot summertime humidity. It's Falls Prevention Awareness Week, in addition to being fall. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than one in four older adults fall each year. But a lot of these are preventable. Dr. B, our friend Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer at People's Health, joins us now to share tips for staying steady and lowering your fall risk. How you doing, Dr. B?
Hey, Tommy, I'm doing great. How about you?
I am okay, sir. Thank you. And steady on my feet. Let's talk about fall prevention. Why is that so important?
Yeah, thinking about falls is really important, especially for older adults, because the consequences can be so dangerous for them. You know, it can cause a lot of serious injuries, things like broken bones or head contusions. We've even had people with internal bleeding. So it's a really serious condition. But then the other thing you have to think about is once you've fallen, it can be very difficult for people to stay independent, especially if they have an injury that prevents them from being ambulatory and getting up and walking around. And the good news is research shows over and over that the fall risk is is actually controllable by things that we do.
You know, I was saying it earlier, Doc, for people that have been through it with older parents, unfortunately, a fall can lead to shoulder troubles, hip problems, and from there, it's just a cascade of downhill health. And if you can prevent it, Lord knows you want to do that. What are some of the things that raises the risk of falling?
Yeah, there's quite a few things, especially as you get older, that make you more likely to have a fall. And that includes a lot of health conditions that older adults can develop. In particular, things like foot injuries can cause difficulty, especially in balance. You know, older adults tend to have some balance problems, especially if they don't take steps to prevent that from developing. And if you're not sure on your feet, you're more likely to fall. And then as you get older, everybody probably knows your muscle mass decreases a little bit and you can develop some weakness, especially in your lower body and your legs. That's going to make you at a higher risk for falls as well. And then we see in our older patients, often they develop a vitamin D deficiency, and that's because they don't go outside as often as they used to. Vitamin D deficiency can lead to fractures. So if you do fall, you're more likely to break a bone. And then the big one that we see probably most often is something called neuropathy. And neuropathy is a condition we see frequently in diabetics. It actually makes your feet feel numb, and so you have difficulty knowing where you're placing your feet, or when you do take steps, you may feel real, you know, uneasy on your feet as well, and that can lead to falls.
Also, vision, I would think, plays a part in this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, older adults who have trouble seeing are really probably about twice as likely to fall. So you want to make sure you're always wearing your eyeglasses or your contact lenses consistently, really so you know where you're going, you're not bumping into something or stepping on something that may result in a fall. And it's really important, too, to make sure as you get older that you get those yearly eye exams. Make sure you're keeping your eyeglass prescription up to date. And if you have a condition like diabetes or glaucoma or cataracts, keep in mind you really need to get your eyes checked annually, every single year. So if you haven't done that this year, you've still got time. Make sure you get out there and get your eyes checked.
Faux pas has become a metaphor for a gaffe, a social gaffe, but it actually means false step in French, which faulty vision can cause, where you think there's a step there or you miss one, and then before you know it, you're down and hurting. What else can raise your fall risk, Doc?
Yeah, another big one we see is actually medications, you know. So there are certain medications that make you more likely to fall, especially the ones that affect you centrally. They affect your brain. And the most common ones are blood pressure and blood sugar medications. What can happen with that is they can actually make you feel dizzy or cause some confusion. So that's going to make it harder for you to stay steady on your feet. So if you're taking any of those medications and you're getting some of those side effects, you want to talk to your doctor about maybe adjusting your medication or even changing your medication to lower your fall risk.
I know I've spoken to a couple of people recently who had loved ones that fell, not because of high blood pressure, but low blood pressure. So it can happen on either side, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, if you're on too much medicine, or maybe you were put on a medicine and then you lost a lot of weight or you improved your diet, your pressure may go too low, and that could make you fall down.
What happens if you do fall, Doc?
Yeah, you know, if you do fall, the, you know, kind of number one is get the medical care you need, especially if it's something severe involving a break or you're bleeding. You may even need to call 911, but you want to make sure you address the immediate needs right away. But then, this is so important, make an appointment to see your primary care physician. It's extremely important that you let them know about the fall, because one fall increases your risk for future falls. And so you want to talk to your doctor about the steps you can take to avoid another one. And then the other thing, too, is your primary care physician may want to check you for bone density. For example, if you developed a fracture, they may want to get a bone density scan on you to see if other treatment may be needed to make your bones stronger.
Some very valuable information from Dr. B. Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. It's Falls Prevention Week, and so much can be avoided if you just prevent that fall. If you do fall, do you have to slow down? Well, we'll find out. We come back. We'll also talk about prevention and more. 820 Traffic Now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, talking about fall prevention. Doc, if somebody falls, does that mean they have to slow down necessarily?
No, not necessarily. In fact, you know, a lot of times after a fall, older adults may try to protect themselves by becoming less active. And that is really worse for you, because if you don't consistently move, you're going to lose strength and agility and that balance we were talking about. That all helps you keep you steady on your feet and actually reduce your chances of a future fall.
What about prevention? How can you lower the risk of falling?
Yeah, the biggest thing that you should be doing to reduce your risk of fall is exercise regularly. You know, it strengthens your bones, it actually helps improve your balance, and sharpens your reflexes as well. So if you do slip on something, you're more likely to catch yourself and avoid a fall. And you want to talk to your doctor about what are those safe exercises for you. It's going to be things that are pretty simple, you know, walking, swimming, stretching exercises and stuff like that. You can really benefit from those simple home exercises.
And some other ways?
Yeah, the other thing we tell people about, you know, if your doctor recommends a cane or a walker, make sure you use it. Some people can be embarrassed about that, but you absolutely shouldn't be. It's really important for your safety to prevent that fall risk. And the other thing is, don't put yourself in situations where you may cause a fall. You know, use a grabber to reach high items. Don't stand on a step stool, especially if you're unsteady on your feet. And then be smart about your clothing. You don't want to wear stuff that's baggy. You don't want to wear shoes that are slippery. And in particular, if you've got hardwood floors or non-carpeted floors, don't walk around in only socks, because you may slip and actually fall down and break something.
Any ways to make a home fall proof?
Yeah, there are a few things you can do. You know, more than half of the falls actually do happen in someone's home. So you want to make sure you look for things like tripping hazards, things that are laying on the floor. If you've got pets, they can definitely get up under you as well. So try to keep them calm and behave. That can be difficult. But, you know, make sure you don't have any loose cables or slippery area rugs around. You want to tape things down to the floor so that you don't step on them and slip.
Some other ideas?
Yeah, some other things you can do. You know, stairwells can be dangerous. Make sure you keep them really well lit. Make sure the lights are on when you're going up and down the stairs. And then you can even put a flashlight next to your nightstand. A lot of times we'll see falls in the middle of the night because someone's getting up to go to the bathroom. They're walking in the dark, step on something, and slip. So that's a real easy tip you can use.
What about keeping the bathroom safe?
Yeah, the bathroom, you really have to address. It's one of the most common places for falls. You know, you imagine, because it's got a lot of wet, slippery surfaces in there. So you want to make sure you have a non-slip mat in your shower. You can actually install grab bars on the walls as well and within the shower. And then if you are really unsteady on your feet, get a shower chair. It's another way to prevent yourself from falling in the bathroom.
What about outside the home?
Yeah, so, you know, the people don't think about this always, but if you have steps leading up to your front door, make sure they're in good condition, that they're not uneven or have, you know, that they don't have broken bricks on them. You want to make sure that you keep all that debris out of your yard as well. Even something like a fallen branch, you could step on, become unsteady, and actually fall down in your front yard. And again, lighting is really important. You've got to see where you're stepping, so keep your lights on at night.
And some final tips for avoiding fall risk?
Yeah, one thing people don't think about is getting enough sleep. If you're not sleeping well, you're more likely to be a little bit groggy, especially in the morning time, and that could actually increase your risk of falls. So at least 7 to 8 hours per night. And then think about things like alcohol in particular, you know, limiting or avoiding alcohol, because that can actually make you unsteady on your feet and sometimes impair your judgment. You may try to do things like get up on a ladder that you shouldn't. And then, you know, when the weather is really bad, especially when we've got a lot of rain going on outside, that's going to make things outdoors slippery. So try to stay indoors when the weather is bad. You're much less likely to fall that way.
You know, one thing I think that I remember telling my mom is that when you get up, take a second to get your bearings about you. Don't just hop right out of bed, right?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of older adults on blood pressure medicines, when you stand up, you can get a little woozy. So stand up, hold on to something, equalize, and then you're good to go.
It'll wait. Take a second. Get your bearings about you. And also, you know, you talk about step stools, Doc. They make them with the handles that rise up. You know what I'm talking about, on the side?
Those can be very helpful, definitely.
So if you get an older parent. Thank you, Doctor. Very valuable information. Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. If you want to find out more about People's Health, I think we'll be out there live in October. You can visit the People's Health Medicare Center in Metairie. It's at 3017 Vets, right next to Party City. Appointments are recommended, but walk-ins are welcome. Very friendly, very helpful. You can go to peopleshealth.com to find out more. You can call them at 1-800-978-9765. People's Health got a 5-star rating. They don't have a lot of those. They don't even have one for every state, but it's the only one in Louisiana. Go to peopleshealth.com. When we come back, we'll talk to Joe Geruso about New Orleans and Entergy and power dependability. Right now, though, a minute late, we go to WWL First News and Chris Miller. I'm so excited. Johnny Tucker, WWL, 844, 16 till 9. I was so excited about John Facenda. I said it was his birthday. It actually wasn't. He was born on August 13th. He died on this date in 1984, but he did do a great job with NFL films. Liev Schreiber does okay. He's no John Facenda, but again, he is married to Naomi Watts, so there is that. Joe Geruso joins us, New Orleans City Council. Remember, how you doing, Joe?
I'm good. Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me what happened at the committee meeting yesterday.
Well, we had a committee meeting yesterday for utilities. I think a couple primary things came out of that. Number one is there was a lot of discussion and really more musings, Tommy, out loud about the tree canopy and how that affects what happens with potentially losing power. And it was a little disappointing because some of the coverage yesterday suggested the council was still staying on course, potentially chopping down trees, which isn't true. And really what we're trying to find is what is the right balance between how we make sure there's an active tree canopy, we live in New Orleans, and then making sure that people aren't losing power left and right just as the wind blows. And then I'd say the other major thing that came up yesterday was about communication, particularly in advance of the storm, during the storm. And I think for me, the biggest item to be highlighted is how, when something goes wrong or is delayed, that is communicated to the public. It's really important. And look, mistakes are going to happen. Things are going to go wrong. There will be unforeseeable circumstances. But how you communicate about that, particularly during the storm, is what ultimately builds credibility and helps out for everyone.
So when it comes to just routine power outages, but last night, I don't know, on the West Bank, we didn't have any bad weather. I don't know what it was like in District A. I see a tweet from the Utilities Committee. 1562 energy customers without power, District A, 5100 District B, 1646 District C. Do you know what caused that?
Yes, there was a breaker that went out at the Durbany station. And in fact, as it happened, I was saying to myself again, you book Tommy Tucker, so that's what caused this. Yeah. Every time you book, something bad happens right before you go on radio. Mm-hmm. And look, this is the second part of the communication, is how you are telling people the work that is being done and actually showing the work that's being done. One of the things that also came up, Tommy, yesterday is Energy apparently does not have an asset management plan, and that's just like a fancy bunch of words to talk about knowing how old their equipment is. And as one of my colleagues said, what is the first thing when you bring your car in to ask you? How many miles you have and how old is it, right? And that's like the first thing that also needs to be known about breakers and transformers and poles and lines. And Energy needs to do a better job of getting that under control. And they've identified certain pieces of equipment called arrestors, which are meant to prevent worst outages from being effective on their equipment. There's some that are just old, and there's some that apparently have a manufacturing defect, but how those are being processed along with all the other equipment is, I think, what's most important to residents. And, yeah, I mean, we had people in districts A, B, and C who lost power, and I think my district has had about 3 power outages per month since January. That's not a good batting average, and it needs to improve.
So how can they not know, like if we're going to carry the analogy of your car forward, you know, I get texts from Carfax or emails that I'm due for an oil change or from the oil change place. You get an owner's manual that tells you when you're supposed to do this, when you're supposed to do that when you buy a car. This is a publicly traded utility, is it not? And I would think that they have to control their assets. How could they not know? I'm surprised by that, Joe. I'm a little astounded, really. Am I missing something?
I was taken aback, too, and I had to probe and asking the question yesterday. And look, I think we're looking at this as a council now, and with our technical advisors, we have outside advisors, because utility regulation isn't an easy thing. And I spoke to them after the meeting and said, we have to figure this out. We can't be in a world where we say transformers, for example, maybe have a 30-year shelf life, and energy can't tell us transformer A is 25 years old or 45 years old. And I think that's part of it too, is we obviously then want to see proactive maintenance as a result, and monitoring that equipment that, you know, is reaching its natural obsolescence. So yes, that is going to be something I think you're going to see us push a lot more for in the next few months, because we're seeing all of these outages happen so often.
See, I kind of find that, we got to take a break here, we'll pick it up, we come back. I kind of find that hard to believe, because it seems like you're talking about a company that makes, you know, widgets, the traditional example of widgets, but they don't know how old the widget cutter is. They don't know how old or what the life expectancy of the widget assembly belt is, or this or that, the other thing. And I find that kind of hard to believe. We'll take a break, pick it up when we come back with Joe Taruso about energy and its equipment and assets, Energy New Orleans, that is. Right now, traffic, WWL. 8:57, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Joe Taruso, talking about the Entergy New Orleans and outages, and the New Orleans Council Utilities Committee yesterday. Joe, what I said before the break, is that accurate or not? I mean, is that what they're telling you? That
it was. Look, we went through sort of a series of questions yesterday about, tell us about your asset management, and I wasn't getting the right answer. So finally I said, all right, answer this question. Suppose there is a transformer on Main and First Street. Could you tell me how old that is? No. Well, that tells me what I need to know in terms of the fact that there clearly is not a proactive system for managing assets, and then what we need to do as a result. And look, we need to make sure that we're doing things that don't impede energy's ability to do their work. And then I think the concomitant responsibility of energy is looking at its equipment, being able to know how old it is, and having a predictable, reliable, knowing maintenance and then capital plan in place to replace those items.
So Entergy New Orleans is a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate Entergy, right? And then from there it goes on to bigger companies?
So Entergy New Orleans, as I understand it, the sister and brother companies are Entergy Louisiana, Entergy Arkansas, Mississippi, et cetera. And then I think they're all subsidiaries of Entergy Corp. So that's the technical legal, but it is a separate, distinct. And remember, New Orleans, separate from the rest of the state, is Entergy New Orleans, and then the rest of the state is under Entergy Louisiana.
It's separate when it comes to liability, but in terms of stock, it's the same. And I'm not trying to get too far into the weeds in this. It just goes.
I think they're two separate companies. I think they're two separate limited liability companies. But there's certainly connections between the two. For example, remember after Ida, when we didn't have power and the transmission lines went down, those transmission lines were Entergy Louisiana's transmission line,
right,
that provide transmission to the metropolitan area, including New Orleans. So they are legally separate bodies, but obviously there is some overlap between the two.
So I'm just saying that strange credibility to think that you wouldn't be able to know what transformers are located where, when you got them, what the life expectancy of them is, because you always have to look toward maintenance and what can go wrong and budgeting. I'm shocked by this. I really am.
I know. Well, I think it sort of happens at the end of the meeting. Unfortunately, sometimes when you've had a 3-hour meeting and something comes up at the end, it gets lost in the shuffle. But this is an important piece, and I think the council members know about it, and that's why we're working with our advisors and our council utility office, because it shouldn't be a shocking piece anymore. It's something that we all need to get fixed and make sure we're headed in the right direction.
Tree canopy would seem to be a red herring at this point, but I don't know. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Take care.
We appreciate your time. I really do. But that's shocking that Entergy New Orleans wouldn't know what transformers are where, or how old each one is, or what the life expectancy on each one is. You would think that's kind of like basic business, right? We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to Courtney Jackson. If the dust-up between Disney and ESPN got you thinking about cutting a cord, we'll help you do that. And then we'll talk with Second Harvest about the Duck Derby coming up. Thank you, Chris. Hoda Kotb's announced she's leaving the Today Show early next year. She got kids that are 7 and 4. She's 60 years old, and she's going to take some time off to spend the time with them, which I think is a very smart decision. We're going to miss her on TV. She's a very, very nice lady if you've ever met her, and we wish her all the best. Courtney Jackson joins us now, our friend, CNET senior streaming editor, to talk about cutting a cord and the dust-up, the problems between Disney and UVerse had me ready to just cancel everything. But then I turned the TV on a couple of Saturday mornings ago, and they worked it out, and all my anger dissipated. Now I'm leaving things just like they are, which I probably shouldn't. So with that, we welcome in Courtney Jackson, CNET senior streaming editor. How you doing, Courtney?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm okay. I want to open the phone lines up here at 504-260-1870 because I'm looking at a story from CNET, Best Live TV streaming service, which is 19 pages long, which is very complicated. And my kid handles all of this for me, my 28-year-old kid, and it just confuses the living bejeebers out of me. So I don't even know how you even start here to determine cutting the cord, streaming, what's best for you, what's not, commercials, plans with commercials, without commercials. To me, Courtney, it's easier just to turn the damn thing off and read a book.
You're not alone, Tommy. My friends are starting to say the same thing.
Tell me how you even begin to go about deciding what's best for you.
First thing you want to do is look at your budget. You know, if you're spending too much on cable, if you have questions about what you've been doling out every month, it's probably time for you to sit down and take a look at how much you're spending on TV and internet. And then compare that with what your family is actually watching every day or every month. Take it from there. If you find that you're spending too much, it's probably time to take a look at something, a live TV streaming service or some on-demand services that can meet your needs, which will cost way less.
Now, I'll tell you, in my case, I was angry at UVerse and Disney for not being able to watch ESPN. So my grown kid did arrange for a new package, but then ESPN worked it out, or Disney worked it out with UVerse. So now I got them both going, and I don't know how many people did that, but that's, I guess, at some point you have to audit what you have.
You do. You have both?
I think. I don't know, Courtney. I don't know what I have. Honestly, I don't.
Okay. So it's unfortunate, but every couple of years we see these carriage disputes pop up between the providers, you know, and the actual services that stream or air these services, whether it's a cable company or a streaming service like DirecTV Stream. And it affects consumers because you're missing out on things for weeks at a time while they try to settle their differences. What happened with that dispute is some customers did wind up canceling their DirecTV subscriptions and moving to alternative sources to catch those sports games that they were missing out on. And some popped up, like Hulu plus Live TV and Fubo, they popped up with deals to help people save money. They took advantage of the situation, slashed prices on their plans, and people were able to sign up and watch everything that they were missing. So back to how to audit your system, audit your services. This is something you definitely want to do. If you're spending more than $100 per month on TV, just TV alone, not with internet, then we do probably recommend that you switch to a live TV streaming service. It will give you all the channels you want. Free DVR is included. The only thing where it may get tricky is when it comes to RSNs. You want to make sure if you're a sports fan that you're getting national and local games.
RSN meaning regional sports networks?
Regional sports networks.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the basics. If I want to get an HD antenna and attach it to the TV, what kind of stuff can I pick up?
It depends on where you live. You can get, most of the time, your basic networks like ABC and NBC. But if you're in a more rural area, you may have difficulty picking up some of those local stations. Antenna is an excellent alternative. That system has made significant improvements over the past couple years across the country in terms of what channels you're able to pick up. We think it's a great investment, especially if you're really trying to save the most money.
So what about the televisions themselves? Because I was at a big box store a while back getting the, you know, the paper plates and the big package and whatever else I had to get, and I overheard a police officer looking at a television set, and I quoted you by saying, you know, it's not just about the reception of the TV in terms of picture, but it's about what the TV is programmed to receive, right, in terms of networks?
That's for antennas, not necessarily your smart TVs. Today's smart TVs come equipped with not only like streaming services that you'll typically use, but a lot of them also have built-in free streaming services. So
that's
for
what
example,
I guess that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah,
different brands of TV have different built-in streaming services.
Yes. So like Samsung TVs offer Samsung TV Plus, which is their free streaming platform, and you get over 100 channels. Google-equipped TVs, they have over 800 free channels built into their system. And then Vizio also has a free lineup of TV stations, and they all stream free live channels as well as a sprinkling of on-demand content.
So when it comes to Google equipped TVs, I have to pay for that or not, or that's included with that?
It's included with it automatically.
So Vizio I have, and I'll never buy a Vizio TV again because it's not, maybe it's an older one, I don't know, but it's not very user friendly, or it crashes a lot, it seems like. But then I have some ONN TVs, I think, that accept Roku, and that's different because Vizio will not accept Roku, right?
If you have a Roku device, they're typically compatible with Vizio TVs. That's one of the devices I use
in my home. What's a Roku device?
A Roku media player. So if you have like a Roku 4K Ultra device or a Roku stick that you just plug into the back of your TV, you're able to install the streaming apps that you use and also use the Roku channel, which is free. It comes automatically with the device. But those devices start at like $30 and go on up. And, again, you can either plug it directly into your TV, into the back of it like a stick. It looks like the Amazon Fire Stick. Or there's a more, they're larger devices that attach to your TV.
Wait, so two of the TVs I have, I don't think I have any stick or anything. It just, when I turn it on, it says watch live TV and Roku is a choice. Vizio doesn't give me that choice. So now you're talking about something I plug into the TV as well?
So you have the Roku channel installed, or you have an actual Roku TV? Because Roku does have TVs.
I think it's an ONN TV. I don't know what the hell I have, but I believe it gets Roku.
Okay, so you have Roku TV built in to your TV,
okay,
which is awesome. It's awesome.
All right.
You know, it's an interface that allows you to access various streaming apps. So through that Roku platform, you probably have access to apps like Apple TV Plus, maybe Netflix, Disney Plus. Do you see those?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not right now, but I mean, I do, but I pay for Prime, and I pay for Hulu, and I pay for Netflix, and I pay for Prime.
Right. So you still have to pay for access to those apps.
Mm-hmm.
The TV companies just make it easier to access them by installing them, pre-installing them on your hardware, on the TV. Yes.
Please keep in mind that you're talking to a guy that doesn't know, as you can have already inferred, no doubt, Courtney Jackson from CNET, a lot about this, and I don't think a lot of people do either. Look, let me bring the audience in. At 504-260-1870, there are no dumb questions when it comes to this.
Not at all.
As it relates to sorting this or putting this jigsaw puzzle together, there's such a disparity of content when it comes to, you know, see a promo where it's like, well, I want to watch that show, but I got to sign up for Apple Plus. I want to watch that show, but I got to sign up for that. I got to watch this one. You can't have them all, right? Because that would cost you an extraordinary amount of money. And you'd never have time to watch them all either.
You can, but there are some people who are exclusively using streaming services and no cable at all. It just depends on how much you want to spend every month or every year. And there are ways that you can lock in deals to drive those prices down for you. You know, so you're only paying maybe $2 a month for one service or $20 for the entire year.
So let's say I want to go full streaming, but I still want to be in touch with the world and have live local TV or whatever. I can do that?
Yes, you can. So if it's just news that you're looking for, some of the free streaming services offer access to local news stations like Tubi or Pluto. Even Hulu, even though you have to pay for Hulu, even basic Hulu offers access to like the ABC News live, mm-hmm. not your local,
right.
but, you know, the more national live feed. But some of the free platforms do offer free access to local news feeds.
So if I'm watching a streaming service and all hell breaks loose with the world, I'm watching a movie on Amazon, okay, or Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Is somebody going to pop in and tell me, oh, by the way, we have a major problem in the world?
No, absolutely not. Not on an on-demand service like Prime Video or Netflix.
Okay.
You're going to have a regular, regular subscription to cable, or you know, hop on your phone and see what's going on.
But you see where you could feel detached with everything that's going on in the world, where you're watching, you know, you're in your own fool's paradise watching, you know, Three Body Problem with the Santee, and then all of a sudden, you know, there are real problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So that's where the decision comes in. You can always get like a low-cost live TV streaming service like Sling TV. The thing with Sling, it doesn't offer all local channels in every market. There's select markets that have local channels. So you'll have to pay more for a service like YouTube TV or Hulu Live if you absolutely have to have news access and also sports access. You'll have to upgrade to a higher platform, higher priced platform.
Let me go to Michael in Jefferson. Got a streaming question. Hey, Michael, you're on WWL talking to Courtney Jackson with CNET. How you doing?
Hello.
Hey, Michael.
I tried Roku. Yes, I tried the Roku route about a couple of years ago, but I didn't like the access to switching when I had to switch the channels. It was hard. It kind of just wasn't as straightforward as your normal TV, cable TV. Has things gotten better where you're able to switch from channel to channel without it being so hard to do?
Well, the thing with the Roku is you do have to, in order to access any streaming platform on through their hardware or their software, you do have to click on the actual app to open it up. It's one of our highest rated devices for streaming. The Roku is.
Wait,
we
you
find
about
it
the
very
stick
easy.
Or TV?
Well, mostly the stick.
Okay.
Mostly the stick, but Roku overall, their interface is pretty slick and user friendly. So you'll see the icons for, let's say, you want to watch Hulu or Netflix. You can place them wherever you want to on your screen so that you have easy and quick access. You know, and open it up. But then with the voice remote for Roku, you can also just tell the remote what you want to watch, and it'll open it up for you.
Did you have a stick or a TV, Michael? I'm just curious.
I don't remember. It's been so long ago.
So what do you do now? What do you watch now for TV? What is your TV situation now at your household? What do you watch? What do you do?
Cable, which I'm constantly saying I need to change because I'm paying so much money.
Yeah.
So I'm right there. I'm about to do, at least I'm going to do it today, probably.
No, you won't. You're like me. You say you're going to do it, but you'll never do it. Call me back in a week and let me know if you did it, all right?
I'm going to do that.
I'll bet you
say,
don't.
Mike, this is Michael, and I changed my cable from
I'll
cable.
I'll bet you don't, because I've said the same thing 1,000 times. I hope you do. Any other questions, Michael?
That's it.
All right. Thank you, Michael from Jefferson. 504-260-1870. There are no dumb questions when it comes to streaming or TVs or sticks or anything in the world. It's very confusing. And I got a question coming in here about Mad Men. Somebody likes Mad Men and wants to watch the series. They're confused about where to find it. And another question is about if you are a nut for one series or the other, how do you go about finding who has it or what movie and how to pay for it and all that stuff? It can be confusing. Courtney Jackson, CNET senior streaming editor, is here. And let me know if you're like me at 504-260-1870. You're ready to just unplug it all and read a book. 924, Tommy Tucker back on WWL. 930, talking to a friend, Courtney Jackson, CNET senior streaming editor, looking at a story. Best live TV streaming service from CNET that is 19 pages long and very confusing, so we're trying to make it simple and taking your calls at 504-260-1870 or texts. Same number either way. Stacy, New Orleans, hi, you're on WWL. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hey.
I have a question because I have YouTube TV live streaming service. Mm-hmm. And I cut the cable about 2 years ago, and I'm really happy with it. I love the interface, all of the channels, all of the features. But it is one of the more expensive of the live streaming services. And so I was wondering if I wanted to go down a step and not really lose much of the features, like what would be the other choices? Now, I did try Hulu live TV, but I didn't care for that one because I could never tell when I was streaming and when I was on live TV. I just didn't like the interface there. But then if I was going to go someplace else, I didn't know what another good choice would be.
So YouTube TV probably has the best channel selection for the price. Hulu Live is actually going to increase its price in October. And then if you step down below YouTube TV, the next thing would be Sling. And Sling offers three different plans. They have Sling Orange, Sling Blue, and then Sling Orange Plus Blue. The thing with that, though, is depending on where you live, you may not get all the local channels. So you could be missing out on, like, your ABC, your NBC stations. And if those are channels that you absolutely have to have, then Sling may not be the best choice for you. But if you're fine, you know, not having those channels, then it's probably a good option because the price starts at $40 a month.
Because I do also have an antenna, which also picks up all of the local stations as well. Do they also have, like, be able to record and that sort of thing on Sling?
Yeah, Sling offers DVR as well. So that $40 price point, that's actually our editor's choice for best budget live TV streaming service. So if you're looking to save, you know, that extra $33 a month, then we recommend that you check out Sling. Sling Blue has a more robust channel lineup than Sling Orange, so I would start there.
Thank you so much.
Can I ask you a question, Stacy? When it comes to YouTube, what do you watch on that? What was your the catalyst for making you go to YouTube and cut the cord?
Well, I used to have Charter before, and they had just gotten so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started looking at other things, and they let you, like, try it out for a week free, like, to see if you like it. So I started trying a couple of things. And it's got, like, all the channels that I used to watch on cable. The interface is really easy. It's got the free, DVR recording. You can pause the TV, rewind it. You can go back and look for shows that you missed, even if you don't record it. So all of the features are great. So now I just have, internet, and then I do the live TV streaming, and it was a lot more affordable, and I could, like, pay for Disney Plus and all the other ones, and I was still cheaper than I was with the cable.
All right, thank you. Hope we helped you, Stacy. 504-260-1870 if you have any questions or comments about streaming. Somebody wants to know about if they had enjoyed this show or that show, or they want to see this movie or that movie. And another text comes in, says that they paid for a movie on this one but found out they could have gotten it free there. How do you go about sorting all of that out, Courtney?
So there are some free apps that can tell you where something is streaming, if it's streaming, and when it's streaming. Some examples are Just Watch or TV Time, and they're free. So you can sign up for those apps and look for TV shows and movies, and some of you might be surprised to learn that some of your favorite TV shows or films are not available on streaming at all, but other times the apps will tell you exactly where you can go. It may be somewhere like Netflix. You may be able to find it on a free platform like the Roku channel, but those apps can help steer you in the right direction. In some cases, Google will be your best bet, but the thing with that is they'll tell you like 6 different options, paid or unpaid or subscription-based. So that can get a little confusing. But we recommend something like Just Watch or TV Time.
Somebody else texted in and wants to know the best streaming service if they want to see classic old movies.
There's some free options for that because there are some fast streaming platforms that air old classic movies 24/7. So check out a service like Pluto TV or Tubi, and even the Roku channel sometimes has those. But depending on the genre, like if it's Westerns, or old horror flicks, you may be able to find that on Tubi or Pluto first.
Somebody else texted in and wants to know, sorry tuning in late, could you ask about Hulu Live TV getting ready to drop DirecTV, paying about $150 a month?
So Hulu with Live TV right now costs $77 a month. Beginning October 17th, they're raising the price to $89 a month. We'll add, though, one of the perks of Hulu Live's platform is that it automatically includes access to Hulu On Demand, Disney Plus, and ESPN Plus. So if you like all of those streaming services, they're included with your Hulu Live subscription. But that price is going up, and that can be a little bit steep for people. So the basic plan goes up to $89, and then their other plan, I believe, is going up to $96 a month. So you're kind of getting into cable territory when you tack on the cost of internet with that one.
See, and speaking of cable territory, let's talk about broadcast TV territory, because take me through the streaming services where you have commercial or commercial-free options, because if I'm paying for TV and I'm watching commercials, then it seems as though I'm back to this is a circular nature that drives me crazy of all of this, Courtney, because if now I'm paying for TV, that I could see, or rather paying for TV with commercials, and I can get free TV with commercials, and why am I paying for it? Am I messing something up here or not?
No, that's the big question. I've had family and friends text me and say, I'm canceling everything because why do I have to watch commercials when I'm back to cable again? But here's the thing. It boils down to personal choice. You can save a lot more money every month or every year if you go with an ad-based streaming plan, whether it's Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus, Max. All of their ad-based plans are going to be the cheapest option for you. If you absolutely want commercial-free streaming, and for some services, that's where I'm at. Like, I'm willing to pay more to watch Netflix without ads. That's also an option. It can get very expensive, though, in terms of the differences. When Hulu raises its price next month, for example, the ad-based plan will cost $10. It's going up from $8 to $10 a month. The ad-free plan will be $19 a month. So that's a $9 difference to decide if you can stand commercials or if you would rather not. So it's all a choice.
Courtney, when cable first came out, my grandparents said, I'll tell you what they're going to do. They're going to put that in your house, and they're going to get you hooked on it, and they're going to keep raising the price. And guess what happened?
Exactly that.
That's exactly what happened. When it comes to streaming services, somebody texted in and said, when they buy a movie from Amazon, do they own it forever?
No, that's not how Prime works. It really is a rental, and typically with Prime, yeah, correct. It's in your library for about a year unless they changed it.
Well, that's misleading to say purchase, don't you think?
I will not comment on that, but that's generally how the system works. Yeah, it's not like accessible for an unlimited amount of time.
So in essence, you'd do better to buy the DVD in a way, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can still get a DVD player. Let's talk about password sharing, because sometimes when I turn the TV on and go to this streaming service or that one, they got people logged on there. I don't know who the hell they are. I don't know if it's friends of my kid or what, and they're sharing. I don't know. How common is that? How much trouble can you get in with that? Is that a good idea, bad idea?
So password sharing has changed a lot. Netflix really catalyzed this movement where they started charging fees. If you want to share your account with anyone outside of your household, you do have to pay an extra $8 per month per person. And they have limitations depending on the subscription type. I don't know if you heard the news yesterday. Disney announced that they were going to start doing the same thing. They initially announced that last year, and it's rolled out as of yesterday. So customers here in the U.S., if you've been sharing your Disney Plus accounts with anyone, you will have the option to pay a fee. There's two separate fees for that, one if you're watching with as, one if you're watching without. Otherwise, those people who you've been sharing your account with who don't live within your household will either have to sign up for their own account or you just kick them off and call it a day. But it's expensive. So if you're keeping your kids on your account, maybe they go to college in a state that's, you know, you're there in Louisiana, maybe they go to college in California and they're on your account, you'll either have to pay that extra fee to allow them to continue to stream or kick them off and make them get their own account.
Here we go. Quick question. I have a subscription to Hulu and Disney, but now it seems I have to go through Disney to reach my Hulu platform. Am I still paying for two different subscriptions?
It depends. That one's tricky. Are you signed up? See, are you signed up for them as standalone subscriptions, or do you have the Disney bundle? One of the things that Disney implemented was a single sign-in with its new My Disney app, so you can log into both services, whether you have a separate subscription to Disney Plus and Hulu, or you have the Disney bundle, which packages them together. You have to look and see how you're being billed. Look into that first, and then that will let you know if you have the bundle or two separate subscriptions.
All in all, to wrap this up, is there any scale, any bang for the buck, best bang for the buck streaming service that you would recommend or what, Courtney?
It all depends on your personal taste. Here's what I recommend right now. Look into bundles. Several services have partnered up this year to offer customers lower price access to streaming. Disney rolled out this new partnership with Max, so you can get Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max starting at $17 a month, which is a great deal. If you want to watch ad-free, the price goes up a couple dollars. Look into that sort of bundle. If you're a Comcast customer, and this is just for Comcast folks, you can get the Stream Saver bundle, which packages Apple TV Plus, Peacock, and Netflix together.
Right,
and it's $10.
All right, one final question. You're under oath here. How many times have you, with all of your knowledge, expertise, and streaming services, sat there and mindlessly flipped through and found nothing to watch?
Well, you know what I do? I rotate my services, so that barely happens. I may only have two services a month, so I know what's coming to Netflix. I stick with Netflix. That's pretty much my default. But it's happened here and there. If there's nothing on Disney Plus, I'll cancel it.
Do you like Three Body Problem?
I haven't watched it yet. I'm behind.
Put it on the list. Trust me, you'll like it. Thank you. Courtney Jackson, pleasure as always. CNET Senior Streaming Editor. We come back. We're talking to John Sillars. The big Duck Derby's coming up with Second Harvest Food Bank. We'll talk about that. 943, 17 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 949 now. John Sillars joins us, Chief Strategy Officer for Second Harvest Food Bank. It's the best time of year, the Duck Derby coming up. How you doing, John?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm okay,
quack,
sir.
Quack, Tommy.
I'm telling you, didn't do it yet, but I will today. I'll get my 100 ducks, so whatever I get for $100. Tell me about how it works.
The way it works is you buy a duck. You can buy one duck for $5, or if you spend $100 on ducks, Tommy, you're going to get 25 ducks. So you do get a volume discount. We take your ducks as well as a bunch of other ducks, 30,000 in total, and we will be pouring them into the Big Lake at City Park on Saturday, this Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. The New Orleans Fire Department will be there, and they're using hoses to kind of push them across the pond. And there's a long chute at the very end, and the very first duck that makes it across is the grand prize winner. That person wins $5,000. Now, there's something special this year where we are going to pick 10 ducks before the race. And if one of those ducks comes in first, not only does the winner get $5,000, they also get $1 million.
Wow.
So it's really big. But then, you know, if you aren't that lucky person, there are a bunch of other winners that go down. There's a $1,000 gift card from Zapardo's, free Canes chicken fingers for a year, a Sun Bicycles retro cruiser from Bicycle World, two nights stay at the Windsor Court, and lots more, lots more. I think Theo's Pizza for a year. It's there. There's a lot of fun prizes. And the day is just an absolute blast. You know, people with kids, bring your family. Not only do you get to see the ducks, there's going to be face painting. There's going to be a band there. There's a cornhole toss. There will be snacks there. It's a really nice way to spend a Saturday afternoon with the little ones.
And how do you find out more about this? How do you buy your ducks, et cetera?
You go to no-hunger.org/ducks, D-U-C-K-S. And it will take you right to the page, and you can buy one duck, you can buy 25 ducks, you can buy as many ducks as you would like.
Tell me about the need, if you will, John, about where all the proceeds are going and how they're going to be used.
Well, it's really amazing because that one duck that you spend for $5 is going to provide 15 meals for people in South Louisiana. We have over 400,000 people in South Louisiana who experience food insecurity. That's about 1 in 6, but among it's about 1 in 4 kids. We actually have the highest rate of food insecurity in the country in Louisiana, as well as senior food insecurity. So it's really bad here in our state. In New Orleans specifically, 1 in 3 kids experiences food insecurity. And so we work really hard to take the money that we raise from the Duck Derby, as well as other fundraising efforts, and we try to feed those people. You know, we just had a hurricane. It wasn't a big hurricane, but it was a hurricane, and we distributed nearly 300,000 pounds of food, water, and supplies. We prepared 13,000 hot meals, and we had 60 distributions in 8 parishes. Now, you know, a lot of the food we get is donated, but what's not donated is the gasoline that powers our trucks, the maintenance, the salaries of our drivers to get down there. And so the funds that we generate from Duck Derby, as well as other fundraising efforts, are used to help us respond to a disaster like a hurricane, but also respond to just the everyday disaster of food insecurity.
And what I do want to be clear about is you don't have to go to the Duck Derby. You don't have to show up anywhere. You can do it all online. It's all on the up and up,
yeah.
Thoroughly vetted and everything else. You buy your ducks, and if you win, you get called, right?
You're absolutely right. Thank you for mentioning that. If you don't have a family, if you're a big college football fan and you're and the game that you want to watch is that afternoon, you can still enter. You can still enter, and we will contact you if your duck won. And so it's you do not have to be present. Winners do not have to be present.
And I'm not trying to be sentimental when I say this. I don't care if I win or not, because I know that $100 on those ducks is going for a good cause. Tell me again the website, John.
no-hunger.org/ducks.
Go Tommy's Ducks. Thank you, John. John Sellers, Chief Strategy Officer for Second Harvest Food Bank, 954, 6 till 10. We'll find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.